Welcome to Riff Talk on RiffManiaRadio.com. A place for new music, upcoming artists, and specialized interviews.
Okay, I'm talking to my good friend, singer Jeff DeBerry. How are you doing today, Jeff?
Doing good, Jason. How are you?
All right, and for anybody listening, this is episode number 3 of Rock Talk. Today, Jeff, I want to talk a little bit about Randy Rhoads. Were you ever much of a Randy Rhoads fan?
Oh, yeah, big time. And I actually seen Ozzy Osbourne back in the summer of 1981 in Chicago with Randy, it was his Blizzard of Oz tour, and Randy Rhoads was the guitar player, and with Rudy Sarzo and Tommy Aldridge on drums.
And what do you remember from that experience of seeing the band?
Oh, it was great. I was real young. Back then I was still in high school. I was going into my senior year of high school. And it was a good show. It was a good concert. I mean, at the time, it was shortly after Ozzy just came out with his first solo album. And a lot of people really didn't know who Randy Rhoads was, except that he was a really good guitar player. You know, I mean, even myself, I wasn't really aware of who he really was. I had never even heard of him before, you know. I just knew he was just some little dude up there with a guitar about as big as him, you know, and just wailing on wailing on the guitar. You know, it was a good show. It was a Def Leppard that opened up for them. I mean, the original Def Leppard with Pete Willis. It was a really good show. I remember it very well.
Well, that must have been quite a show. Now, I think a lot of people don't realize, like you were saying, at the time, at that time period, you know, Ozzy had just left Sabbath, and a lot of people were predicting Ozzy to go on to even greater success, which he, of course, did. But what people fail to realize is, like, during the Black Sabbath days, Ozzy wasn't much of a songwriter. He had Geezer Butler write most of his songs in Black Sabbath, and then what people maybe didn't know at the time was Randy Rhoads was a much more gifted musician than Ozzy, and he really helped him write a lot of those songs and bring them to life. I mean, I've heard stories that Randy was a classical musician. And so I think it's what people fail to realize, that Randy was the guy that really helped Ozzy bring that, that band to life. The two albums Randy did with Ozzy, I was curious, Jeff, which one was your favorite?
I like Diary of the Madman. Diary of the Madman the best.
Okay.
That was my favorite one. That's a really good album. Blizzard of Oz is great. The production and stuff on Diary was a lot better. And I just personally like a lot of the songs down there more than on Blizzard of Oz. But I'm not trying to take away anything from the Blizzard of Oz album. I mean, that was a great album. You know.
Yeah,
I believe that on the Blizzard of Oz album, the band that Ozzy toured with wasn't the band that played on the album, except for Randy Rhoads, because I believe it was Bob Daisley on the bass, and I'm not sure who the drummer was. I don't remember. But on the Diary of a Madman album, I'm almost certain that it was the same band that he toured with, which would have been Rudy Sarzo, Tommy Aldridge, and Randy Rhoads.
Yeah, I think the drummer was Lee Kirksley, who was, I think, the original drummer from the English band Uriah Heep. Now, of course, the reason we're talking about Randy Rhoads is a few weeks ago I read an article where Randy's family is suing this guy, Peter Margolis, who was a former student of Randy's. He was supposed to be making a film about Randy's life. Have you heard anything about the film, or do you know anything about that, Jeff?
No, I haven't heard nothing about it. I just have this article that you had sent me that I've been reading about this book and this companion DVD. No, I haven't heard nothing about that.
Okay, well, basically what this was, like I said, is Peter Margolis is this guy who was guitar student of Randy's back in the day. And a couple years back, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of talk got started about this guy Peter Margolis wanted to direct a film and put like a documentary together about Randy's life, and he went to the family, and apparently they gave him the go ahead, and they gave him a lot of personal items belonging to Randy and some photos, and there's been a lot of talk about this film being made, and then for whatever reason the film got shelved and stopped getting talked about, and nobody ever heard what became of it. Then about maybe about a month ago, I was reading an article on the internet where the Rhodes family is suing this guy and some of the people that backed him, because instead of going forward with the film project, they decided to, for whatever reason, shelve that, and they put out a book now where this Peter Margolis and some of his backers are claiming to be Randy experts, and they've actually, I guess, used some of the photos in the book without going to the family. Do you have any opinion on any of this?
Well, I don't know, you know. I'd like to check this book out, you know, if and when it ever comes out. But as far as them suing, I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't know why they'd want to, or maybe, I don't know, Jason. I mean, why they would want to sue them, why they want to sue them, I don't know.
From what I can tell, from what I was able to read, see, this guy presented himself to the family, again, and it was somebody they knew because he was actually a former student, about wanting to make a film. And instead of making the film, he in turn decided, without telling them, okay, I'm not going to do film anymore, I'm deciding to do a book. And I guess they felt that he was less than truthful, and he's trying to pass himself off as an expert. Now, my feelings on the matter, of course, I only know what I read, but I think if he went to the family with the idea of doing a film, that's a project he should have gone forward with, and if it was unable to make it happen, he should have said, look, you know, I can't do the film for whatever reason, but I'd like to go forward with the book. What do you think?
If his information isn't correct, mm-hmm. You know, and especially if he hadn't consulted with Randy Rhodes' family, then I guess I could understand why they'd be upset about it, you know. Randy Rhodes was a legend, you know, and if someone's going to do a documentary or write a book or a biography or whatever it may be, they need to have their information correct, you know, and not be just going by what they think or what they may have heard, and you know, stuff like that. But now that you explain it a little better, I can understand. I mean, I probably feel the same way, you know, if it were relative to mine, you know.
And again, I only know what I read, but I can tell you back at the time, you know, going back to maybe about 3-4 years ago when this film started being talked about, this film being made, this guy, Peter Margolis, put up a Facebook page. He was all over the internet doing interviews. And in light of this recent lawsuit, I tried to reach out to him to see if I get any comment from him, and he no longer has a Facebook page, you know, no internet presence, so I kind of find that odd, and that if he was really innocent, like he probably wants people to believe, why would you not at the very least make some kind of public statement that, you know, this is what happened with the film, this is why I decided to release a book, you know, at least tell his story. But it appears anyways that he is hiding. Again, I only know what I read, but you know, this is an opinion that I have come up with based on information that's been presented, you know. And on a happier note, the article I sent you, Jeff, last night about the book and the DVD, that is a totally separate project, and I felt I've had the pleasure of interviewing the gentleman who put that book out, which his name is Ron Sobel, and he used to be the photographer and the lighting director for Quiet Riot, like from 1975 to 1985, and he was personal friends with Kevin Dubrow and Randy. And so, on a positive note, he's a guy that I got a chance to interview, and I could tell from talking to him that he put his book and DVD out kind of, you know, out of, it really came from the bottom of his heart, you know, doing it to pay respect to two of his fallen friends, you know, talking about Kevin and Randy. So So that is something I really suggest you check out, you know, for anybody that's a Randy fan. And I can give you a website to go to. It's www.randyrhodes.com. Let me correct that. www.randyrhodesbook.com/. And again, this is a book that's finally coming out. And the great thing is a lot of the stuff when you hear about Randy Rhodes is from Ozzy era. This is from the Quiet Riot period of his life. Is that something you think you might be interested in checking out, Jeff?
Most definitely. I mean, I've never actually heard anything from Quiet Riot with Randy Rhodes playing guitar. Everything was always with Carlos Cavazo, you know, who was a great guitar player in his own right, you know, a very similar guitar player to Randy Rhodes, but he's not Randy Rhodes. But yeah, most definitely. I mean, I'd like to check out some stuff by Quiet Riot with Randy Rhodes. Like I said, I've never even heard anything by them with him actually playing. But yeah, this is something that I would definitely be interested in.
And you know, oddly enough, back in 1993, they actually released Kevin DuBrow actually put out a compilation CD. It was called Quiet Riot: The Randy Rhodes Years, and they picked out some of the best songs that he played on throughout his career of Quiet Riot. And oddly enough, the first two Quiet Riot albums that were originally released just in Japan, that's the stuff that features Randy, and a lot of people in the United States have never heard it, and it's actually a lot more commercial and pop oriented than, of course, what he did with Ozzy. But it's worth checking out if anybody ever gets the chance. And that was the great thing about talking to this guy Ron Sobel, who was a photographer for Quiet Riot. You know, he said putting this book out was a labor of love, because he said, for one thing, he says a lot of my personal photos had been stolen or ruined. And he said shortly before Kevin DuBrow passed away, he had a lot of copies of these photos I had taken, and he said so a lot of those photos that he gave me earned the book. And if anybody ever seen the Quiet Riot Beyond the Music special, Ron told me a lot of his photos were in that special. So that's the kind of stuff you're going to get out of this book. And again, talking to him, I could tell this is a guy that well, of course, he's going to make money putting out the book. It's not all about cashing in, for him, which I think is a great product to have out there. Because again, Randy was only, there's not a lot of stuff left from Randy. I mean, like, you got two albums with Ozzy, and I think this is just very neat for fans to be able to go and see. Okay, this is from early on in his career. This is Quiet Riot year. This is where he got his start. And being a Randy fan, I got to ask you, Jeff, being that he only did the two albums with Ozzy, are you amazed at the huge legacy this guy left behind, just having two albums that he left behind?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, you had, before Randy Rhodes, you had, Eddie Van Halen, and in my opinion, Eddie Van Halen is a great guitar player, of course, but in my opinion, I actually like Randy Rhodes a lot better. And I just, sometimes I sit and think, and try to imagine, what he'd be like if he hadn't, died so young, and if he were even still alive today, if Ozzy would, I tend to think that Ozzy would still be playing with him, I don't see why he wouldn't, because I can only imagine what he would be like, today, like I said, when I seen Ozzy years ago, I was just in awe at, because he did a guitar solo, and he was something else. It was a lot of fun, and it was just something to see, something that I'll always remember, and I'll never forget. And when I heard when he died, I was very sad, and. I knew a lot of my friends liked him, and all the other musician friends, guitar players I knew, he was a big influence, and I'm sure he still is today, on many musicians and guitar players, I would definitely like to check out this book here.
And
the DVD.
And you know, the amazing thing about it is, even some of the guys that followed him, and Ozzy's band following his death, you know, like Jakey Lee was a private next guy that came in after him, and even as gifted of a guitar player as he was, you know, because a lot of the fans were so in love with Randy that when Jake first joined, you know, he'd often get people flipping him off on stage and yelling Randy's name, and I think it was often very hard for a lot of those guys who came in on Ozzy's band, you know, after him. And have you ever got a chance to hear the live album Ozzy put out with Randy? It's called, I think, Tribute. Came out in 1987.
Oh yeah, I don't have a copy of it anymore, but I used to have a copy. I used to have a copy of it. I bought it when it first came out. And because it was basically the same concert that I seen, you know, pretty much the same song list, and it sounded pretty much like the concert that I went to. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, after Randy died, he brought in Brad Gillis from
Night Ranger.
Night Ranger, you know, and then he did that that Speak of the Devil album, that live album.
Yeah.
I know, and it just wasn't, I mean, Brad Gillis is a great guitar player, you know, but it wasn't the same, you know, it just I felt it just wasn't the same. I've also seen Ozzy with Jakey Lee, you know, and when I seen him in Chicago was on the, the Bark at the Moon, the Bark at the Moon tour, and I wasn't really impressed with Jakey Lee. First of all, he was really drunk on stage, and he was stumbling. I mean, he was, you know, stumbling all over the place, and they could tell he was drunk. You know, I mean, he played well, but he was just, I mean, I just wasn't impressed with him at all. You know, I didn't care much for him. And then I've also seen Ozzy with what's his name?
Zach. Zach Wilde.
Yeah, Zach Wilde. I've seen the last time I've seen him, which would have been like around 92, I think, which would have, that would have been a No More Tour, No More Tears Tour, or No More Tours Tour, when Ozzy was so-called supposed to retire and never did. I like Zach Wilde a lot. He you know, when he was with Ozzy, he reminded me a lot of Randy Rhoads. You know, I mean, he played his solos to a T, you know, plus his own stuff. He was, I mean, in my opinion, a far better guitar player than Zach Wilde, I mean, than Jakey Lee, you know.
And I think that's the reason Zach's been able to be a lot more successful. While he's definitely admitted to being influenced by Randy, he's not a full-on Randy Rhoads clone. You know, he's got his own thing going, and even with his own Black Label Society, now he's fronting the band. He's singing as well as playing piano, and so he's got his own little thing going. And I think that's why he's been able to be so successful on his own. So now you're talking about last time you saw Ozzy was back in 1992 when he was supposed to go on his farewell tour. Did you see Black? Was that when Black Sabbath opened for them, or?
No, I seen them in Chicago. I actually seen them twice on that tour because when Ozzy did that tour, he before he went out and played the big stadiums. He was doing, when he first went out, he was doing a small theater, a tour of small theaters, and he played at, I don't remember the name of the theater it was in Chicago, but it was like a ballroom. Oh, it was the Aragon Ballroom, that's where it was, in Chicago, and the Aragon Ballroom, I mean, it was a general, like a general admission type concert. I mean, you had to have tickets to get in, but there were no assigned seats, so you had to, wherever you found a place to stand was where you were, and it was me and my a friend of mine that I went with. We decided. He says to me, he says, well, let's go get in the front row. And I was like, oh no, wait, dude, we're never gonna get in the front row. But we walked all the way down there, and we actually pushed our way right, and we were right. I mean, I was front row. I mean, Ozzy was about maybe 2 feet away from me, and then, you know, Zach was on the right, and then the bass player. And Randy Castillo was the drummer, and it was a great concert. The band that opened for them was Infectious Grooves, some members of Suicidal Tendencies, and I can't remember who else was with them. But that was one of the best times. I mean, that concert was one of the best Ozzy shows I'd ever seen, and it also that was also the last concert that he played the last one that he did on that theater tour, because he broke his ankle in that concert. He was there in the middle of Crazy Train. You know how he jumps up and down? He was jumping up and down. He came down and he broke his ankle. And that kind of put a kibosh on the rest of that. He was out for a little while. And then I see him a few months later at an outdoor theater in Tinley Park. It used to be called the World Music Theater. Now it's called the Tweeter Center, I think. They may have even changed the name of it again. Some friends of mine decided to have done the day of the concert to get lawn seats and go check it out. And it was really good. We missed the opening. No, I did miss the opening band. It was, I believe it was, Faster Pussycat opened up for them. I think there was someone else before them that we missed, and I don't know who it was. Oh, Ugly Kid Joe. It was Ugly Kid Joe, Faster Pussycat, and then it was Ozzy. That was a good show, too. That was really good.
Wow, what a bill. Now, I'll give you an interesting footnote. You may or may not recall, back on that tour, when Ozzy was doing his performance in Los Angeles, that was a gig where Ronnie James Dio just rejoined with Black Sabbath, and he wanted that's supposedly going to be his last show ever in L.A., and he wanted Black Sabbath to open up for him. But Ronnie refused to open up for the band's former singer, so he didn't show up for the gig. So they actually got Rob Halford to fill in for him that time, and then shortly after, that's when Ronnie left Black Sabbath for the second time. So, of course, like I was saying, Jeff, we were talking about Randy Rhoads because of this lawsuit the family's filed. And I just the last thing I'll say on the matter is, you know, I think, you know, it's a shame that the film never came to fruition, because for a simple fact, there's never been any real film or documentary made about Randy or his life. And I think the fans were looking very forward to this, and it's a shame it never... never came to be, but at the same time, I'm very happy that I came across this other DVD and book put out by Ron Sobel, who was actually a friend of Randy's and Kevin DuBrow's, and he was the band's official photographer. And again, later you'll hear my feature interview with him during this show, and you can tell it's a guy that just really, you know, he was there back in the day, and he had nothing but love for Kevin and Randy, and a lot of this putting the book out is just out of love and respect, and, you know, from memories he has from that time in his life. And so I think people hear this interview I did with him, they'll really enjoy it, because it's coming, you know, it's something, you know, there's something positive. And again, for Randy fans out there, it's something that's finally being released from a quiet riot period, which there's really not, like you said, not too much out there. And I think it'll be something quite enjoyable, because while it's $69 for a book and DVD, and that may seem a little pricey, if you go on the website, you can at least see that it's nicely presentable book. I mean, it's pretty decent sized book. It's that have a DVD to go with it. So I think for the diehards, it would be worth checking out.
Yep.
And now
my phone was dying. I had to pick up a different phone.
Okay. And now, while we're on the subject of Ozzy, I was curious, what do you think of, are you looking forward to hearing the new Black Sabbath album that's supposed to come out in June?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I like Black Sabbath, I like their old stuff, but I've never been a real huge fan. You know, I've been more of a fan of Ozzy's solo stuff. You know, it's, I don't know whether I'd, you know, go out and buy it or not. I mean, I'm sure there'll be stuff on, you know, the internet. I would absolutely listen to it, you know.
And yeah, again, I'm with you. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I'll probably go out and buy the CD, or at least, like you said, check it out for what it is. But to me, it's not a full-on Black Sabbath album, for the simple fact that you know, they got the main three guys. They got Tony, they got Geezer, and they got Ozzy. But you know, they had a little fallout with the drummer Bill Ward, and they've got now some guy playing on the album who drums for the band Rage Against the Machine. And, you know, I'm kind of interested to hear how they picked him to play on the drums and for the album. But, you know, I don't know if that's a full-blown-on reunion. I was much more of a Black Sabbath fan from the Ronnie James Dio era, just because, like I said before, I think he took the band to the next level. and you know, he was such so much a stronger writer than you know, than Ozzy. Now changing gears for a minute, I'd like to ask you, Jeff, are you at all a Queensryche fan?
I love Queensryche, one of my favorite bands.
What do you think of? Yeah. I'm sure you've read some of the stuff on the interview. What do you think of the fact that there's now two different versions of Queensryche?
I haven't heard nothing about that.
Okay, I'll have to send you.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if it's a version without Jeff Tate, it's not Queensryche. I don't care. I mean, who the members are. I mean, I just that's not Queensryche.
I'll have to send you some info. I can't believe.
I mean, you know, Chris DeGarmo left the band. I actually seen Queensryche, back in, maybe in 2004. I seen them in New York, in upstate New York, and seen them in a club up there. And there was all the original members, with the exception of Chris DeGarmo. He wasn't with them. And they were. I mean, to see them in a small setting like that, you know, and being so close to the stage, and because I mean, Scott Rockenfield is one of my favorite drummers, and to see them, I mean, they were just incredible. They were just incredible musicians. I mean, they even did in the middle of the show, they all came out and did like an acoustic set of some of their songs, and it was incredible. I can't imagine a version of Queensryche without Jeff Tate, you know.
And let me ask you, what's your favorite Queensryche album?
The Warning.
Oh, okay.
I love The Warning. It's my favorite, all-time favorite Queensryche album. I think it's one of the best heavy metal albums that ever put out. I mean, quite honestly. I mean, I remember back in the day when it first came out, I used to say that it sounded like a heavy metal orchestra, you know, because I mean the production and just Jeff Tate's voice and the Scott Rockenfield's drumming, the dual lead solos with Chris DeGarmo and what's the other guy's name? I can't think of his name.
Michael Wilton.
Off the top of my head.
Michael Wilton.
Eddie Jackson. Michael Wilton. Yeah, Michael Wilton and Chris DeGarmo and then Eddie Jackson on the bass. I mean, they were just that's I love it all. I still have a copy of it and I still listen to it all the time.
Yeah, I go back and forth between Operation Mindcrime and Empire, but I got to say, a lot of earlier stuff, like even the Rage for Order, you know, is really, really heavy. If you go back, that's when they're really at their heaviest.
Rage for Order, when that album came out, I bought a copy of it, but I didn't care as much for that one as I did The Warning, you know. And I also like, I still listen to. I have a copy of their EP with the song Queen of the Reich and You Were Black, and I mean those are some great songs. I love those songs. I'll sit on YouTube and watch the videos of those songs, you know, and crank them up, and you know, that's some of my favorite stuff. I liked Operation Mindcrime a lot too. That would probably be my second favorite album, was Operation Mindcrime. Empire, there's a lot of good songs on there, but to me that's I guess I could say, I'd like to, you know, it's kind of like, I guess they kind of sold out, you know what I mean, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great, when I seen them back in 04, they didn't play a lot, they played a few songs off their album, they played a lot of the older stuff, and they had a new album out of the town called Tribe, which I don't think it ever did any good, I don't know, they played a couple songs off of that, but, that Operation, they played a lot of songs off of Operation Mindcrime and The Warning.
See, the thing I've always loved about Queensryche is that they're a band that's kind of they got a great sound to start with, but like they've always kind of done their own thing. They didn't necessarily care with what was going to sell or what was going to popular, like you said. But probably the last big selling album they had was probably Empire. That's had a lot of MTV hits and stuff. But you know, since then they've become really more of a progressive band, rock band, and they kind of, you know, go with whatever floats their boat at the time or whatever they feel like making. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised you haven't heard about all this, Jeff, but yeah, there's Queensryche has turned into one of these other bands that there's now two different versions of. The band had a falling out with Jeff Tate, and so they basically voted him out, but he wasn't so willing to go, so they're now in a legal battle over the name, and right now the judge in the case is allowing both camps to use the Queensryche name, and Jeff Tate kind of has his all-star band. He's got Rudy Sarzo in his band, who we were talking about earlier, and of course Simon Wright, he was a drummer in Dio, and a couple of other guys. But I think he's going to be more successful because he's the voice. You know, that's when people think of Queensryche, that's the guy they think of.
The thing about that kind of stuff, Jason, you know, I mean, it's kind of the same thing. Like, remember, I remember a while back we did a blog about L.A. Guns and how there were two different versions, you know, and now Queensryche, and then I also went to go kind of move to, like, you know, this Guns N' Roses thing, you know, with this, basically, in my opinion, is just the actual Rose band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, but still going, but using the same name, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I mean, Jeff Tate, I mean, he would be great just solo, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And having those musicians, you know, playing with him, you know, I mean, instead of just calling it Queensryche, just be Jeff Tate, you know, mm-hmm. and go out there and do his thing. Because I think, for all practical purposes, he would probably draw just the same amount of people if it was true. Because, I mean, he was like, you know, he's the voice of Queensryche. You know what I mean? And it's the same with, like, you know, when I was never a big Guns N' Roses fan, but I'm a big fan of Slash. I can't stand Axl Rose. But, I mean, just like with him, for instance, you know, he's going out there under the name because he owns the rights to all the music and the name, but it's not Guns N' Roses. It's the only member of Guns N' Roses that's in that band is Axl Rose. I mean, I don't care how good they sound or how well they can you know, copy Guns N' Roses music. It's not Guns N' Roses. You know, it's like Queensryche. I mean, without, you know, Eddie Jackson and Michael Wilton and Scott Rockingfield, you know, at least Scott Rockingfield. I mean, it's not Queensryche. You know, they might be playing their music. That's Jeff Tate singing, but it's not the band Queensryche. You know, I mean, and even the same goes. Well, I mean, but then, you know, I can look at a band like Kiss, with, you know, where they replaced, you know, Ace and Peter, and actually are an even you know, better band musically live than they've ever been, because, you know, I mean, they're just Tommy Thayer and Eric Singer are just, in my opinion, more technical and more accomplished in musicians, you know, and it just, but, you know, with Kiss, it's like Gene and Paul are Kiss. They've always been Kiss, you know what I mean? So they're always going to be Kiss, no matter who they have playing with them.
Yeah, and
they went through that whole thing for years with different members and stuff.
What I'll say on that is, you're saying, that's a different situation than the Gene and Paul are Kiss. And what I mean by that is, if you go back to, you know, I mean, it's hard to believe they're celebrating 40 years of Kiss this year, but
yep.
Those are the guys that they wrote most of the songs. They wrote,
exactly.
You know, they sing most of the songs. Yeah, if you go back to some of the classic albums, Peter and Ace sing on the albums, but, you know, Gene and Paul have kept it going all these years. They're the ones, at the end of the day, say what you will about them, but like if Peter, Chris, and Ace Frehley were the huge talents they think they are, they would have successful solo careers. They would be selling just as many albums as Kiss, but, you know, for whatever reason, they're not. Even if you, I don't know if you've had a chance to read Peter Criss's new book, have you?
No.
Okay, well, again,
I'm not really much of a reader, to be honest with you.
It makes for an interesting, I'm not much of a reader, but I like to read some of these biographies, and Peter's book is, it's a good read. It makes for an interesting read, but the tone of it is from a guy that's very bitter and angry. He even talks about in the book, for example, you know, that signing away his rights to the makeup, he blames other people for it because, you know, I didn't read the contract. Some guy told me to sign here. Well, if you're stupid enough to, you know, sign away your rights to something like that because somebody else tells you to without reading the contract, you have nobody else but yourself to blame. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. Well, they can say what they want about Gene and Paul. Oh, they're, you know, they're crooks or whatever, but they're the ones that have kept it going all these years. They're, you know, they're smart enough to keep it going, and they own the rights to everything. That's on them, you know.
Gene and Paul, you know, they're not crooks. Gene, especially Gene Simmons, he's a businessman.
Yeah.
And, you know, besides being a rock and roller, I mean, Kiss is like a corporation. They're a business. You know, they're a money-making machine. they've always been, you know, not just their music, but all the memorabilia, all the Kiss style. I mean, I like watching, you know, Gene Simmons' Family Jewels, and they did a roast, and I don't know who it was that said that, you know, Gene will get up and slap the name Kiss on any piece of crap that's out there, you know, and which is true, and he makes something to make a lot of money. You know, Ace Frehley and Peter Criss were not, I mean, they came, Gene and Paul started the band, then they got Peter, you know, and then they brought in, you know, Ace Frehley, Ace and Peter were never, I mean, they were always, you know, especially when they got in the reunion tour, they were on like salary, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, Gene and Paul were kind of like the owners. And anybody else, Ace and Peter, and I mean all the other Bruce Kulick, you know, Eric Carr. I mean, they were all just hired hands, and you know, but they were part of the band. But when it came to like ownership and the rights to everything, they really did. They didn't, you know, embellish in any of that. You know, Peter Criss came up with the cat makeup, Ace came up with the space makeup, so I guess they would have a right to that. But as far as anything else in the rest of that band goes, it's all been about Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. And in particular, Gene Simmons. You know, Gene Simmons is not, I mean, he's an entrepreneur. I mean, he owns businesses, he owns properties, he owns all kinds of stuff. I mean, besides Kiss. He owns his own, record label and his own studio and, it just, you know, the list goes on, you know. But I mean, getting back to Queensryche, you know, I would go see Jeff Tate, you know, with whoever he has playing with him. But to see another band called Queensryche, well, I mean, even if it is some of the other members of Queensryche, if Jeff Tate's not up there singing, I'm just not interested in it whatsoever. Not even remotely interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, they got, I don't even know the new singer's name. His name is Todd something. He's from the band Crimson Glory, which is a much heavier band. You know, so that tells you right now they're going for a much heavier sound with their new stuff. And, you know, all the more power to them. But, again, when I think of Queensryche, I think of that classic band. You know, I think of, you know, Scott Rockfield, Christy Armo, Jeff Tate, and all those guys. They're the ones that made the band. And, I just can't picture another guy singing those songs. I'm sorry. I mean, they could get, you know, they could even get a name guy, and it just would not be the same. But I would probably be more willing to go see a Jeff Tate show just because that's the guy I grew up, you know, singing those songs.
It'd be almost like trying to replace Rob Halford and Judas Priest. You know, you can't do it. It's not. There's some bands. You know, really. I mean, in all honesty, you know, a band that has grown in popularity over a number of years, and the fans are used to a singer, you know, to one singer, you know, just like Skid Row, for instance, you know. I mean, I've seen Sebastian Bach twice solo, but I would never, I mean, but I did see Skid Row without him. They opened for Kiss in 2000, but I wasn't there to see them. I was there to see Kiss, you know, and the singer sounds good, sounds a little bit like Sebastian Bach, but it's not him, you know. It's not him. It just wasn't the same. It's not, you know, it's not the same thing anymore. And bands that have really popular singers, like, you know, Skid Row or Queensryche or even Iron Maiden. You know, Iron Maiden tried to replace Bruce Dickinson, and that didn't work out very well at all. You know, he came back because it's not the same. Even though Paul Di'Anno was the original singer, it was Bruce Dickinson. It was with Bruce Dickinson when they gained their popularity, you know, and that's who people know as the lead singer of Iron Maiden. You can't replace people like that. They have a certain persona. I mean, they're the voice of that band. You know what I mean? I would not pay money, especially with the cost of concerts today. You know, like, you almost got to take a second mortgage out on your house just to go see a concert nowadays. You know, I want to see the original guys. I want to see the original singer. I want to see the original, you know, I mean, at least the original singer. And if I'm going to see that singer, then, I mean, I mean, why call it Queensryche? Why call it Guns N' Roses? Why call it, you know, L.A. Guns? Why call it, you know, anything? You know, just be, you know, like Ozzy. Ozzy didn't get a bunch of musicians together and call it Black Sabbath. He called it, you know, it was just Ozzy. Dio didn't get a bunch of, even though Ozzy does play some, and Ozzy does play Black Sabbath songs in this concert, just like Dio played, you know, some Rainbow songs and Black Sabbath songs. It was still Dio. It wasn't Black Sabbath. You know, he didn't take out a second version of Black Sabbath. You know, I think the whole thing is just stupid.
Yeah.
It really is. It's just dumb.
At the end of the day, all it's about is, you know, really a name. And what I mean by that is, okay, like you ask, why did they do this? Well, you know, these guys, they've been in the band Queensryche for 25 years or whatever. That's their bread and butter. And rather than start over from scratch, they'd rather, you know, fight over the name. And it's very unfortunate because, like, especially you take a band like L.A. Guns, which I was always kind of a fan of from back in the day, but what I didn't like about the battle over that is you got two different versions of the band. And, you know, in L.A. Guns, the problem was you have two guys that each own 50% of the name, Tracy Guns and then the drummer Steve Riley. And neither side's willing to back down. You know, they're both trashing each other and trying to get the fans, you know, to go on their side. And it really ruins it for the fans because, like, what I'm thinking is, well, like, if you take a look at the L.A. Guns thing for a minute, okay, to me, Tracy Guns, being that he's a guy that formed the band, you know, after he left Guns N' Roses, he gave the drummer 50% because they were partners and the drummer was the band's manager and helped him out a lot. And then, so, you know, in my mind, Tracy always had more of a right to the name, but they both equally own 50% and yet they're going around, you know, trashing each other and neither guy's willing to budge. But in the end, Tracy Guns got tired of it. He just said, you know what, I'm not going to run L.A. Guns' name into the band, ground anymore than I already have. He's formed a new band called League of Gentlemen, and he's kind of gone on his way, and he's allowed other guys to go on with their version. So, you know,
I commend him on that, you know. I mean, you know what I feel, I don't think that any of these guys are thinking about the fans, which are the ones who made them who they are. If it weren't for the fans, they'd be nobodies.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care how good they are, they'd be nobodies. And you know, when you hear about stuff like that where they're, you know, there's, you know, this guy's got one version, this guy's got another version, they're fighting over their name. You know, all they're thinking about is themselves. Their own, you know, they're not thinking about the fans. Well, what do the fans want? You know, I would want to do what the fans wanted, you know, because that's your bread and butter. Those are the people that are putting money in your pocket. Those are the people that are buying your albums. Those are the people that are paying, you know, I mean, and like nowadays, what, over $150, $200 for a concert ticket to go see a band, you know, some, you know, I mean, you want to give the fans what they want. You don't want to give them what you want. It don't matter what you want.
Yeah.
Because it's not about you. It's about the fans.
And,
you know, without fans, where are you? Who are you?
Yeah,
you're nobody.
And the silly thing about it, like in a band like L.A. Guns' case, they're not even a band that sells out arenas anymore. They're playing, you know, little tiny clubs, and they're still fighting. Like you said, at the end of the day, I got more respect for a guy like Tracy Guns. And, yeah, he was fighting over a name for a while, too. But again, it was more his than the other guys. And at the end of the day, I say, okay, you know what? He did the right thing. He's doing something fresh. He's doing something new. And then once he did that, the other band said, you know what? We appreciate Tracy doing the right thing. We wish him nothing but luck now. And so, you know, they got what they want and whatever. So I guess that ended on a happy note. Now, changing gears for a minute, I'd like to ask you, because we're talking a little bit about Iron Maiden, and I know what a huge Iron Maiden fan you are, Jess. So you want to tell our listeners a little bit how you first got into Maiden?
Well, I mean, the first time I ever seen Iron Maiden was on MTV years and years ago, when MTV was actually when they played music and when they were, you know, when it was good. You know, I mean, the first time I ever seen them was when, you know, Paul Di'Anno was I seen videos of them with Paul Di'Anno. I didn't care much for him because I just didn't like the way he sang. But then, you know, when they came out with Number of the Beast, and the first video that from that from an album was Run to the Hills. And when I seen that and I seen Bruce Dickinson, I mean, I was just sold, because I mean, Bruce was, I mean, his voice fits that style of music, you know, better than Paul Di'Anno's, you know, ever did, you know. I mean, Iron Maiden, in my opinion, is the greatest heavy metal band of all time. I mean, as far as other heavy metal bands, they all stand in line behind them. They're the best. I mean, they're the best. You have one of the greatest bass players in Steve Harris, you know, one of the greatest, you know, heavy metal, and honestly, I actually like, you know, Bruce Dickinson more than Jeff Tate. I think he's a better singer. I think he's, I mean, where Jeff Tate is, you know, Bruce has more of a, even nowadays, you know, Bruce, I mean, when I seen Queensryche, you know, back in 04, Jeff Tate wasn't hitting those notes no more. A lot of it because he smokes and drinks and stuff like that, you know, and whereas Bruce Dickinson, who doesn't do that kind of stuff, sounds better today than he did 25 years ago. You know, I mean, would you see an Iron Maiden? Because I have the Flight 666 DVD, you know, and I mean, Bruce Dickinson sounds better today than he ever has in his entire career. You know, when, and you can't say that for many singers, such as like Jeff Keith of Tesla, who sounds like today just sounds like total crap. He don't got it no more. I don't know what happened to him. He ain't got it no more. You know, when you look at a band like Iron Maiden, they're like fine wine. They just get better with age. They're not, I mean, and it's the same band, you know, they brought in, now they have three guitar players instead of just the two. Because when Adrian Smith rejoined the band, they didn't kick out, I can't think of his name.
Yannick.
Yannick Gears, you know, they didn't kick him out. They just brought him right along. Now it's like a guitar onslaught with three really, really, you know, super talented guitar players, you know, and a bass player that, in my opinion, I mean, the only other bass player that I could compare, that I would compare Steve Harris to, would be maybe Geddy Lee, you know, but Rush is an entirely different style of music. It's not progress. It's not, you know, hard, heavy metal music. Like, they're more progressive rock, but it's a different, you know, different style. You know, but I mean, Steve Harris, I've seen Iron Maiden. I've seen them on back in 1985 on their Power Slave tour. You know, and those, I mean, they were just phenomenal. I mean, they were just a phenomenal band to see live. I mean, to see a band that sounds that good live, you know, because however you sound live, that's how good you are. And I don't care how you sound in the studio. When you get out there and you play live, if you sound like crap, then you sound like crap. You know, Iron Maiden, I've never heard them sound like crap. Dickinson hits every note, no matter what it is. He don't cut his notes off short like Jeff Tate does now. You know, where like in Take Hold of the Flame, where he hits a real high note at the beginning of the song. When I seen Queensryche, he just goes, "Take hold." You know, he didn't even hold the note or nothing. He couldn't hit it no more.
You know,
Dickinson, I mean, I just have a lot. I mean, Iron Maiden, to me, like I said, is the best, the greatest, and this is just my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, is the greatest heavy metal band of all times. I mean, they're the ones that started that kind of music, you know. I mean, all these other bands came out after them, like Queensryche. I mean, I started liking Queensryche because they reminded me a bit of Iron Maiden. You know, I was an Iron Maiden fan long before Queensryche was ever even around. You know, and they're just, and as far as heavy metal music goes, Iron Maiden is my favorite band of all time.
Wow, you know, and like you were saying, you know, Jeff, you know, in hearing those first two Iron Maiden albums that Di'Anno was on, they sound nothing like Iron Maiden now. In fact, you know, they stood the test of time, I guess, because they're classic, and that's where the band got its start from. But even Steve Harris has said in interviews that, you know, reason they let go of Di'Anno because he felt that they were very limited with what they could do with him. And it's just amazing that Bruce is one of those guys that, you know, there's very few replacement members that go on to have greater success than the guy they replaced.
Yeah.
And
Bruce Dickinson is not just a great vocalist. He's also a commercial airline pilot. He's qualified for the Olympics in fencing. I mean, he's smart. He's it's just, I mean, the, I'm a huge fan of Bruce Dickinson. You know, he's, and so is my wife. You know, we're both huge Iron Maiden fans. You know, and you know, it's just everything about the guy. You know, he's you ever listen to him talk. You know, he's intelligent. You know, and he knows what he's talking about. You know, especially when it comes to music, and the fact that, you know, he was once, you know, offered to be a judge on American Idol. You know, and he declined because he said that he could not support giving somebody a record deal that has not had to pay their dues. You know, and I thought about that, and it's like, you know, he has a point there, you know, he was under a lot of fire, a lot of scrutiny and stuff from people because he wouldn't do it. And it's like, he just don't care. He don't care what they think. You know, they offered him a ton of money, and it wasn't about the money. He just wasn't gonna do that, you know. And I admire someone for that, because I have to agree with them, you know, and stuff like that. Because really, you look at American Idol, how many of these winners have actually gone on to become superstars? Only one that I can think of, and that's the country singer, what's her name?
Carrie Underwood. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and stuff like that. I mean, it's all this is a TV show to me, you know, and I can understand why he wouldn't want to do that, you know, because it's just a bunch of baloney.
And I mean, that would have been interesting to see him on American Idol, but you know, I gotta admit, when Steven Tyler joined the cast, I didn't,
one of the worst judges I've ever seen.
I didn't watch it too much. I checked out a couple episodes, but the only thing I thought about him being a judge that was kind of cool was, I thought to myself, okay, there's a guy who's actually, like you said, paid his dues. He's been in the music business 40 something years. He knows a little something about it, as opposed to even a guy like Simon Cowell, who, well, Simon's a producer and he created that show.
Yeah.
He's a guy that has made a living criticizing other people, who's got no musical talent of his own, you know? So I thought...
Well, exactly, but I mean, Simon Cowell is a record executive. I mean, he's a guy that signs, that you know, you sit down with him, and he's the one that signs, you know, gets you signed.
Yeah.
You know, and he plays a very important role in the music industry, you know, so he does know talent when he sees it and hears it. And, I mean... But I used to like to watch American Idol when Simon Cowell was on it, because he was entertaining. You know, he was more entertaining sometimes than some of the contestants.
Yeah.
You know, just his sarcasm and his stuff. I mean, sometimes he went a little overboard, but he told people like it was. I mean, he didn't hold nothing back, like how Paula Abdul did. You know, I mean, she just loved everybody. You know, except for maybe every now and then. And to me, that's how Steven Tyler was, especially the females. You know, I mean, which is, you know, I love Steven Tyler. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a big, huge Aerosmith fan. You know, but I didn't care for him much on American Idol. I just didn't like him on there. And I'm glad he left and went back to doing what he does best, and that's being the lead singer of Aerosmith.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Anyways, folks have been listening to Rock Talk, and before we go, Jeff, of course, I have to ask you a couple things that I noticed on your website today. You had a couple new cover songs that you had posted. First of all, there was one called Oh No, which I understand is a Commodores track. You want to talk a little bit about that and why you decided to cover it?
Well, I mean, I like to rock. I like doing rock songs. I like, you know, rock and rolling. But I also like all different kinds of music. I don't limit myself to just listening to one particular style of music. You know, I love anything that sounds good. You know, I'm a huge fan of a ballad if they're good, if they're done right, if they're good. You know, Oh No is I've always been a fan of Lionel Richie. I've always liked the Commodores for years. You know, I mean, I don't come out and say it, you know, all the time, but I mean, it would take too long to sit and really, you know, go through every artist, you know, that I find appealing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a song. I've always liked that song. You know, I've always liked it, and I just decided to cover it. I've actually done a few cover songs. You know, I did a cover last year. I did a cover of Every Rose Had the Storm by Poison. I did a cover of A Daydream Believer by the Monkees, I've never been big on doing cover songs, but if I'm going to do a cover song, I'm going to do it right, and I'm going to do it you know, making my own, and I'm gonna do it because it's this song is that I like. It just happens to be a song that I particularly like.
And the reason I brought that up is because interesting thing about your cover of Oh No, I gotta admit I'm well aware who Lionel Richie and the Commodores. I've never heard that particular song though, and I think the cool thing about doing something like that is you can actually release a cover of a song like that, Jeff, and turn other people on, you know, to the original version,
yeah.
Maybe, or, you know, to go check out who the Commodores are. And I think that's really, you know, a cool thing about doing covers like that.
Well, this song, Oh No, is actually from an 80s movie called The Last American Virgin. That's where I heard that song the first time. And it's in a movie. I don't know who played in the movie, a bunch of no-name actors,
yeah.
But it was a movie that came out in the, I think it was maybe the late 80s. It was called The Last American Virgin, and it was a song about, you know, I mean, a movie about teenagers and trying to get laid and stuff like that, and it was, you know, but that song was, that's where that song came from. It's from the soundtrack.
And then, of course, the other one I want to ask you about is that you just posted up there was today, Fallen Angel, another Poison song. I got to ask you, who's the guy singing the background vocals? Because, I mean,
got some friends. Just, I don't really.
Okay.
I'm not gonna
reveal that.
Just had a couple of people helping with the background vocals. But I like doing Poison. I like Poison. I like them a lot. I may even cover another one of their songs. And what I'm gonna do is, I mean, I'm putting together like an album. I may just release it as a free, you know, just give it to people for free. You know, if they want it, I'll send them. I'm gonna make a cover for it. You know, and the CD. And because I really couldn't go on, you know, and sell it because that would, you know, I'd get in trouble.
Yeah.
And it would be a tribute to, you know, different bands and artists and songs that I've grown up with and that I've liked over the years. And I'm planning on doing some more too.
Well, that's
and, yeah, Fallen Angel. I just finished that song up.
That's the next thing I was going to ask you because. You know, I've enjoyed the cover songs you've released, like you said, Daydream Believer and Every Rose. And for when I talked to you, you weren't too big of a fan of doing cover songs. Is this something that you've become more comfortable with?
Yeah, I mean, at first, you know, I mean, I like I said, I'm not really a big fan of doing cover songs. I don't know. Every now and then I hear a song, it's like, man, I wish I wrote that song. You know, or so, you know, things like that, and it's like, you know, of course I didn't write them, but I can do my own version of them, you know, and just I see a lot of artists doing that, you know, I see a lot of people like that kind of stuff. It helps build my fan base a little bit more, and I can turn them on to my music, you know, and it's just something that as a musician, you know, that I like to show that, you know, I can do more than just write my own songs. Like that, you know, I can play cover songs if I want to, you know, if I want to.
That, you know, I think you're at a point
where it comes down to.
I think you're at a point where you've proven that you can definitely come up with your own original material, and I kind of like the idea when I read today that you're, you know, thinking about doing this cover CD, because just in hearing the version of Fallen Angel you put out today, I mean, I have to admit I'm a Poison fan, and I was a big fan of the original version, but in hearing your version, I gotta say. You really made the tune your own, you know what I mean? And I think that's another great thing about putting out cover songs is if you can cover somebody else's song and yet, you know, put your attitude and your heart and soul in and really, really make it, you know, sound like it's all, you know, all your own, that's a really great thing. I mean, even looking at Quiet Riot, they did those two Slate songs. I remember a couple years ago I interviewed Frankie Benelli and he was telling me, he said, the thing is, you know, he says, Quiet Riot, you know, Quiet Riot got the fame. He said those two versions of those songs are actually bigger than the original versions, but
oh, yeah.
But Slade, they got the money. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, like I said, the cover song is just something that I just felt like doing. You know, I have to pick songs that are in my range that I can actually sing. And Bret Michaels is in my range, you know. I mean, I can sing probably about any Poison song that's out there. Just as, I mean, I'm thinking about maybe doing a cover of Look What the Cat Dragged In, which is another one of my favorite songs.
Uh-huh.
you know, I think I may be doing that one. And I'm also going to work, I'm also, another song that I'm in the process of working on right now is the one, really the one and only hit song by the Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays. That's always one of my all-time favorite songs. I love that song, Bob Geldof. And that's another one to be watching for, and it'll be coming up pretty soon.
Wow, okay, I have to check that out when it comes out. Now, let me ask you, your version of No Lie, that's just basically you sitting down at a keyboard and singing?
What song?
The Commodores cover?
Yeah, I did all that with my keyboards and my drums.
Okay, again, really nice. And again, folks, you've been listening to Rock Talk with Jason J. Rock Houston and Jeff DeBerry. Now, before we wrap things up, Jeff, for today, is there anything else you want to let our listeners know about?
Not really. Just be safe, keep on rocking, make every day count, and everyone have a great week.
Okay, we will do that, Jeff, and I'll be talking to you again really, really soon. So I want to once again thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this, because it just would not be the same doing it without you, and I can honestly say that.
Thank you, Jason. It's my pleasure. That's a lot of fun.
Okay.
You've been listening to Riff Talk on RiffManiaRadio.com. If you're interested in being featured on one of our shows, please visit the appropriate section of our website. Until next time, keep on rocking and banging that head.